Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. This episode is part two of our Get Lit Festival preview. If you missed part one, you can find it on our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org, or by subscribing to The Bookshelf podcast. Get Lit is Spokane's annual literary festival. This year's festival is April 22nd through 28th at locations throughout Spokane. First, Greg Spatz, who's director of Eastern Washington University's MFA in Creative Writing Program and author of two novels and two short story collections. He's also widely known as the fiddle player for the bluegrass and roots music band John Reichman and the Jaybirds.
I'm Greg Spatz. I will be reading as part of the MFA alumni and faculty reading. Sunday, April 28th, 4 p.m. at Interpunct Press, 2618 West Cinto Avenue. I'll be reading from my new book called What Could Be Saved. It's a collection of novellas and stories. I'm calling it Bookmatched Novellas and Stories, which I guess is something like linked novellas and stories, only it's sort of different. The idea is that the stories are not connected by narrative connections. Some characters do show up across all the different pieces, but mainly they're connected by subject matter and theme and obsession. So I'll be reading a section from early on in the first novella, the title novella, which is What Could Be Saved. Growing up, he hardly touched a woodworking tool. For one thing, there was his father's sovereignty. No sense competing against a man whose trade had so fully defined him and that he, in turn, had helped to define, and in which he'd spent his entire adult life in a state of complete and selfless absorption. The notion of comparison or competition was irrelevant. His father had already won. He'd pre-won. He had always and would always have pre-won. And anyway, he wouldn't have consented to competition if challenged in the first place. You want to build, he'd say? Too happy, too willing to share, Paul knew. We'll start with scraping some ribs. Let's go. There was more to what kept him out. Still, he hadn't found the right words for it. Only a shrug when customers of his father used to ask about his plans and whether he might someday try his hand, take over the business. Sure, doubtful, I don't know. At first he felt he was saving the option. Why or what he was saving it for, he couldn't have said. He'd seen what his father had gotten for his sovereignty and dedication. A room full of molds, models, and tools. Rare violin books full of color plates, mentions in the Strad magazine, medals and certificates. A daily activity to engross him without any break, ever. A clientele that hung on his words and trusted him in all matters violin-related, treated him with the deference of a sage or guru, but without understanding what he did and without fairly compensating him. Fingers that reported back to him in ways he could neither describe or calibrate, yielding knowledge of how a piece of wood was going to respond under pressure, orders that came all at once or not at all. When he was younger, he'd spend afternoons and slow times on weekends in the shop. He learned the names of tools and processes and occasionally helped his father to select wood blanks for a new instrument. In retrospect, he supposed his father could only have been humoring him. Once when he was 9, he surprised them both with an ability to identify differences between the scrolls and corners of various old Italian makers in one of the books of color plates his father kept in the workshop. That one's a Strad, and that's a Guarneri, right? The shape of this, whatever it's called, and this is a Maggini. He flipped more pages and kept going. Strad. How he knew, he couldn't say. The names were already familiar. He'd been seeing and hearing them for as long as he could remember. The shape to go with each seemed only a natural, logical extension and an easier way to tell one thing from another. Isn't that interesting, his father said. You figured that out all on your own? Really? Hey, look at me. You're cheating. You read the chapter titles. And when Paul shook his head no, his father asked, so what's this one then? Amati. Excellent, that's excellent. Great eye. And this? And this? His father flipped randomly to a page in another book, the paper scuffed and dented with ghosts of his own handwriting. Letters, numbers, lines transferred through tracing paper, a brown half ring of varnish or spilled blacking floated to one side of the image like a cookie with a bite out of it. The finish of the violin in the picture, blown up in the middle, pigmentation darkest at the edges, reminded Paul of the uneven film of suds and color left in his parents' beer glasses after dinner. Look here. No guesses? I don't know. His father tapped two fingers on the page and traced the outline of the seabout. He drew in his lips and puffed air through them in a way that normally indicated amusement, but here seemed to mean something else, while his fingers continued moving up and down as if the violin's shape corresponded with some unspoken longing or mystery. Late Guarneri spent a lot of time with this one, as you can see. He ended by brushing his fingers along the spilled varnish. I don't know, fairly atypical for the rest of his work, right? You might say he was slipping a little in his old age, dipping into the sauce or rushing to get the orders out, messing up his blocks. Still so uniquely beautiful, it's a paradox. What do you think? Would we let an instrument go out of the shop looking like that? Being included in his father's attention to violins this way was like standing under one of the high-powered lights by his workbench and seeing all the grains in your fingernail and the bits of dead skin on the surface of every wrinkle in the back of your hand. Such clarity, it was a form of erasure. If he said any more, he'd fail them both. The look on his father's face now, too, was so much the same as when he first examined an instrument he'd recently finished, lifted at arm's length. He'd angle his chin to one side and the other, nodding, grunting, spinning the instrument back to front, front to back, nodding some more. Not bad, not bad. Measuring against some internal standard until it dawned on him. The imperfection, the flaw or flaws, whatever inscrutable details or misbegotten choices among all the better details and choices caused the final product to fall short of some ideal. It was all Paul could do to remember to keep breathing. I don't know, he said. It's okay, I was actually trying to trick you, his father said. Never mind, not fair. I'm impressed, though, a real visual sense. I wonder where you came by that. The next several days after this, his father was busy varnishing new instruments and, between coats, finally getting serious about an overdue restoration job on an old violin that had been mostly destroyed in a house fire. Paul watched from the leather chair by the window and tried not to interrupt with questions or suggestions. Please, his father would say, please, not today. The restoration job was a torment for him, not only because of the painstaking work of building the plates back splinter by splinter, but because something about agreeing to take it on put his father at odds with a dealer in the city. Double for nothing, he explained. Oldest trick in the business. You total the instrument, scam the insurance, and sell the customer a new violin with the claim money. Later, whenever you feel like it, when no one's looking, you fix the so-called totaled violin, write some new papers for it, and no one's the wiser, and off it goes. It'd be like, here he paused, hands on his hips, say I owned a toy store and I took one of your Transformers and broke it. Well, maybe I don't break it, but it gets broken somehow, and then I tell someone to pay you to buy another one for me, top dollar, by swearing that the first one can't ever be fixed. And never mind. This made no sense to Paul. No, his father said, bending again to his work, of course not, because as soon as anyone decided it was a good idea charging crazy money for old Italian violins, as soon as that happened, it became the most corrupt business in the world. It doesn't make sense. And before and after dinner, more of the same, complaining to his mother. Can you even imagine? All she wanted was her Obici back. Still, for weeks afterward, hoping his father might remember, a visual sense. I wonder where you came by that. He went around mumbling the names of builders, hoping his father would overhear. Obici, Del Gesu Guarneri, Tononi, Bergonzi, Stradivarius. A kind of incantation, recitation to invite attention, to get his father to lift his eyes like that again, full of wonder, really seeing him. But this never happened. Eventually, he stopped waiting, let the few little projects he'd begun, a clumsy top of wide-grained spruce, a neck blank of flawed wood nicked and scarred around with rasp marks, a handle for his own knife, gather dust, kicked aside in a box under the bench. Who had spurned or forgotten whom, he couldn't say, but long after the visit stopped and other after-school activities took up his time, chess club, swimming, track, the cedar chip walk between the house and his father's workshop felt raw to him, a nightmare tightrope walk past a chasm, a place not to let your eyes linger.
That was Greg Spatz, reading from his new book, What Could Be Saved. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. This episode, we're showcasing a selection of the authors participating in Spokane's annual Get Lit Literary Festival. Next up, Ellen Welker, author of two books of poetry, Ram Hands, published by Scablands Books in 2016, and The Botanical Garden, published by Astrophil Press in 2010.
Hi, my name is Ellen Welker. You can find me at Get Lit events all week long as an attendee. And on Friday, I will be attending Yoga for Writers. That's at 8:30 a.m. at the Yoga Shala. And afterwards, I'll be reading with Janica Stuckey a couple of poems. And that night, Friday night, April 26th, I'll be moderating the Poetry Salon at the Spokane Public Library downtown with poets Kaveh Akbar, Kelly Sherman, Janica Stuckey, Claudia Castro Luna, and Anastasia Renee Tolbert. So I wrote this first poem for an event this past fall supporting the work of FutureWise, a statewide public interest group whose mission is to promote healthy communities and cities while protecting farmland, forests, and shorelines. The event was called This Land is Your Land and was a celebration of the unique agricultural landscape of the Palouse. The poem is called Reverently Costco and has an epigraph by Wendell Berry. I walked the deserted prospect of the modern mind where nothing lived or happened that had not been foreseen. Reverently Costco. For what grows is exchanged for a 24-pack of tube socks. The teeming field of crickets for aids for independent living. For a farmland becomes a desert in which prospectors sift and shuffle through Kirkland's signature green and red Dianju pears and the memory of bounty. The prospectors mind a mine glittering with wearable technology and supplier diversity, exclusive memberships, return policies, and as for the future, a boundless optimism. A bounty advanced selecticized paper towels, white 24 rolls kind of optimism. A euphemism, really. Might not pan out or dab up nor match up with what is, in fact, foreseeable. Palouse sunsets adorned with condos in which cornucopias of plastic abundance serve as centerpieces. The plan is reverently capitalistic, reverently paved, reverently cul-de-sac, cash card, security, and surveillance. The plan is defiantly front lawn, defiantly wheatland lane and prairie place, defiantly reverently air-conditioned, defiantly supersized, defiantly snacks. What had been the overworld had become the underworld, and lo, to see is to dream of sterilization no more. The mind a bleached aisle now, and isn't this peace? Isn't this an end to suffering? Isn't this a contented sigh, knowing what to expect and when? Isn't this wide open space that we made different and better than the one we found? Now we can cultivate what we want. For we are done with the weather, its mercurial tendencies. We are done with the future and the past. We have our mantra, and it is YOLO. It is be here now. It is manifest destiny, and it is our inheritance. It is carpe diem, and any violence this does our offspring and their offspring and their offspring's offspring will certainly be overcome with technology. The world has always been changing. It's our time now. Time for HGTV and the big reveal, Game of Homes. And isn't this Nextdoor app the best thing since going outside? To know everything through the eyes of one's neighbors, through the lens of peering out from within, and with safety in mind, and community, but on our own terms. We got the Night Owl 8-channel 5MP DVR wired security system with four cameras. They had it at Costco. For what grows cannot compare to what's available. For what grows cannot compare to what's on sale. For what grows cannot compare to this mighty convenience, these mighty members-only savings, this mighty cathedral of bulk purchasing power. What grew here holds no candle to our apocalypse readiness. We are stocked up. We are not afraid. We have Kirkland's signature boneless, skinless, bone-in, skin-on, uncooked, pre-cooked breasts and tenders, wings and thighs. 5-pound tankards of various powders and chows. family-friendly snacks in 55 individually wrapped packages of classic onion and dill, spicy jalapeno, ranch, sweet southern barbecue heat, sea salt and vinegar, garlic lovers, extra cheddar, and pizza mix. Tear and reseal, snack and resnack, microwave and serve. And isn't a farm stand overpriced and a farmer's market does not have what we need? You know who has what we need? Costco. The answer is anything we want. For what was outside is better inside. What was lived is on demand. What was experienced individually can be rated collectively. What were private encounters with the world are still private encounters with the world. This world, 72 degrees Fahrenheit, a leather sectional, a ProForm Pro 5000 smart treadmill with iCoach gathering dust by the window. It's fine. We got it at Costco. From in here, everything is possible on our time, our schedule. We see now how nature is our enemy, one best combated with optimism. Though, is that the right word? We just make the world how we want it to be. We are the change we want to see in the world, and what we want to see is a gated neighborhood, manicured lawns. If you lived here, you'd be home. And don't we hope that for them, too? Isn't it a shame about those people? Isn't it a shame about the farmland all bought up? Isn't it a shame, but that's the way it goes. Did you hear about that girl? Did you hear about that thing? Did you hear about that deal at Costco? Select living room sets, ancient grains granola, mixed nuts, whole dried blueberries, bacon crumbles, fruity snacks, Kirkland signature all. Costco, it's not even that you're so bad. You're not the worst, but you slid in and blew up like bloat, flashing your low, low prices. Showing us how empty we are inside your giant warehouse, fields of suburbs where our food once grew. And isn't this country ours for the taking? A desert we made, then blew life into. Well, then isn't poetry the beginning of a spell? I was going to say against disaster, but there are so many to choose from. Spell against a warehouse club slash investment broker, a cheap hot dog with drink. Spell against another bleached aisle. This poem is called Kindness, and though you won't be able to tell it on the radio, it's an abecedarian, a poem in which the first letter of each line sequentially follows the letters of the alphabet. Kindness. A few people want to write love poems, but absolutely nobody wants to read them. Charged with the good sex other people are having, as well as dicks past and everything. I tethered my falcon, went outside where my children couldn't listen, got smashed, and hid kindness. Picked up the phone. I was calling you at the appointed time. Jambon beurre, jambon beurre, it was stuck in my head, so became my mantra, kind of an occupy the tongue, the body will follow thing. Language is like that. Reading and speaking and licking milk from kindness's talons. This my tongue did while my body spilt with no, 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 no. May I sing a healing song for you, for us? On second thought, I'll hum it, the pure vibration in our respective skull sutures and all, a quiver of arrows tips over in a corner of the mind. Really, my interior mirrors the world we have made. I have a fondness for signs with a blankness on their face, telling me nothing but actively. Under what sky can anyone vie for a kindness untethered to some sick power or other? Whether raptor or reptile, you know xenophobes love only their own. And that's my problem with yoking kindness, as I, a woman, have been taught to do. Watch her zero in on her prey, killing fast and without fury that which fuels her when dead.
That was Ellen Welker reading her poem, Kindness. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. And we've been featuring local authors participating in this year's Get Lit Literary Festival, which is taking place at locations throughout Spokane, April 22nd through 28th. Find the full schedule and details at gitlitfestival.org. For The Bookshelf, I'm Chris Messini.